2.4 Amy Schneiderman had been sleeping in his old bedroom for the past 4 years. Noah Marks had vanished for a time and then resurfaced. And the 13-year-old Ferguson, who had just entered the 8th grade, wanted out. Since he wasn't in a position to run away from home, where would he have gone and how could he have lived without money? He asked his parents for the next best thing. Would they please ship him off to a boarding school the following September and allow him to spend his 4 years of high school in a place far from the town of Maplewood, New Jersey? He wouldn't have asked unless he had known they could afford the expense. But life on a grander scale had continued to flourish at ever more exalted heights since the family moved into the new house in 1956. 2 more stores had been added to his father's growing empire, one in Short Hills, the other in Parsippany. And with local consumers now splurging on 2 and 3 television sets per household, with dishwashers, washing machines, and clothes dryers now considered standard equipment in every middle-class home, with half the population sinking money into voluminous deep-freeze receptacles to store the frozen foods they now preferred to eat, Ferguson's father had become a wealthy man. Not yet a Rockefeller, perhaps, but a king of suburban retail, the renowned prophet of prophets, whose low prices had killed off the competition in 7 counties. The spoils from this expanding income now included a pistachio-green 4-door Eldorado for Ferguson's father, a snappy red Pontiac convertible for his mother, membership at the Blue Valley Country Club, and the demise of Roseland Photo, which marked the end of his mother's brief career as an independent breadwinner and artist. The fad for painted-over photographs had run its course. The studio was just barely breaking even. So why bother to go on when sales at the 5 stores were stronger than they had ever been? And with all this getting and spending, all this jitterbugging opulence, Ferguson failed to see how boarding school could possibly be a burden to them. And if they happened to object to his plan, meaning if his father happened to object, since he had the last word on all matters concerning money, Ferguson would counter by offering to give up Camp Paradise and work summer jobs instead, which would help reduce their share of the costs. He had been researching the matter for several months, he told them, and the best schools seemed to be in New England, mostly in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, but also in Vermont and Connecticut, with some good ones in upstate New York and Pennsylvania, and even a couple in New Jersey. It was only September, he realized, 12 whole months before the start of the next school year, but applications had to be sent in by mid-January, and unless they began narrowing the list of potential schools now, there wouldn't be enough time to make an informed decision. Ferguson could hear his voice trembling as he spoke to them, he and his smug, unknowable parents, sitting around the dining room table on a Tuesday night during the fall of the Kennedy-Nixon campaign, a family dinner for once, something that happened less and less often now because of the late closings of the stores and his mother's newfound passion for bridge, which kept her out of the house 2 and 3 nights a week. And there they were in the dining room as Angie Bly shuttled back and forth between the kitchen and the table, bringing in the dishes for each new course and removing the ones from the old, vegetable soup to begin with, followed by thick slices of roast beef with mashed potatoes and a mound of buttery string beans, such excellent food cooked by the brusque and capable Angie Bly, who had been cleaning house and cooking meals for them 5 days a week for the past 4 years. And now that Ferguson had swallowed his last morsel of roast beef, he finally spoke up, finally found the courage to talk about the thing that had been burning inside him for months. He watched his parents carefully as the words left his mouth, studying their faces for signs that would tell him what they thought of his plan. But mostly they looked blank, he thought, as if they couldn't quite absorb what he was saying. For why would he want to leave the perfect world he lived in? He who was doing so well in school, who took such pleasure in playing on his baseball and basketball teams, who had so many friends and was invited to all the weekend parties, what more could a 13-year-old boy possibly want? And because Ferguson was loath to insult his parents by confessing that they were the reason why he wanted to go away, that living under the same roof with them had become almost intolerable to him. He lied and said he was hungry for a change, that he was feeling restless, smothered by the smallness of their small town and longing to take on new challenges, to test himself in a place that wasn't home. He understood how ridiculous he must have sounded to them, trying to put his points across and make compelling, sophisticated arguments with his out-of-control, unpredictable voice, his post-boy, pre-man pipes still oscillating from high to low and back again as they sought their ultimate register, a vocal instrument that lacked all authority and command, and how ridiculous he must have looked to them as well, with his chewed-down fingernails and the newborn pus blob sprouting just to the left of his left nostril, a little no-one who had been blessed with every material advantage in life, food and shelter and 1,000 comforts. And Ferguson was old enough to know how lucky he was to dwell in the upper echelons of good fortune, old enough to know that 9/10 of humanity was cold and hungry and menaced by want and perpetual fear. And who is he to complain about his lot? How dare he express the smallest note of dissatisfaction? And because he knew where he stood in the big picture of human struggle, he felt ashamed of his unhappiness, revolted by his inability to accept the bounties he had been given. But feelings were feelings, and he couldn't stop himself from feeling angry and disappointed, for no act of will could change what a person felt. The problems were the same problems he had identified years earlier. But now they were worse, so much worse that Ferguson had concluded they were beyond fixing. The absurd pistachio-green Cadillac, the lifeless, immaculately tended precincts of the Blue Valley Country Club, the talk about voting for Nixon in November. They were all symptoms of an illness that had long infected his father. But his father had been a lost cause from the start, and Ferguson had watched his rise into the ranks of nouveau riche vulgarians with a sort of numb resignation. Then came the death of Roseland Photo, which had thrown him into a funk that had lasted for months, since he knew there had been more to it than a simple matter of dollars and cents. Closing down the studio had been a defeat, a declaration that his mother had given up on herself, and now that she had surrendered and gone over to the other side, how grim it was to see her turn into one of those women, yet one more country club wife who golfed and played cards and knocked back too many drinks at cocktail hour. He sensed that she was just as unhappy as he was, but he couldn't talk to her about it. He was too young to meddle in her private affairs. And yet it was clear to him that his parents' marriage, which had always made him think of a bathful of lukewarm water, had now gone cold, degenerating into a bored and loveless cohabitation of two people who went about their own business and intersected only when they had to or wanted to, which was almost never. No more Sunday morning tennis at the public courts. No more Sunday lunches at Grunning's. No more Sunday afternoons at the movies. The day of national rest was now spent at the country club, a Valhalla of silent putting greens, whooshing water sprinklers, and squealing children romping in the all-weather pool. But Ferguson rarely accompanied his parents on those 40-minute drives to Blue Valley, since Sunday was the day when he practiced with his baseball, football, and basketball teams, even on the Sundays when there was no practice. Seen from a distance, there was nothing inherently wrong with golf, he supposed, and no doubt a case could be made for the benefits of lunching on shrimp cocktails and triple-decker sandwiches, but Ferguson missed his hamburgers and bowls of mint chip ice cream, and the closer he came to the world that golf represented, the more he learned to despise golf. Not so much the sport itself, perhaps, but certainly the people who played it. Priggish, sanctimonious Ferguson. Ferguson, the enemy of upper-middle-class customs and manners. The know-it-all scourge who looked down upon the new American breed of status-seekers and conspicuous consumers. The boy who wanted out. His one hope was that his father would think sending him to a well-known boarding school would enhance his prestige at the club. Yes, our boy is at Andover now. So much better than public school, don't you agree? And damn the expense. There's no greater gift a parent can give his child than a good education. A long shot, to be sure, a vain hope hatched from the self-deluding optimism of a 13-year-old mind. For in point of fact, there was no reason to hope. Sitting across the table from him on that warm September evening, his father put down his fork and said, "You're talking like a greenhorn, Archie. What you're asking me to do is pay twice for the same thing, and no person in his right mind would fall for a con like that. Think about it. We pay taxes on this house, don't we? Very high taxes, some of the highest property taxes in the state. I don't like it, but I'm willing to fork over the money because I get something back for it. Good schools, some of the best schools in the country. That's why we moved to this town in the first place, because your mother knew you'd get a good education here, as good as any education they can offer at one of your fancy private schools. So, no dice, kid. I'm not going to pay double for something I already have. Verstehst?" Apparently, boarding schools were not on his father's list of show-off expenditures. And because his mother then piped in and said it would break her heart if he left home at such a young age, Ferguson didn't even bother to mention his idea about working summer jobs in order to help with the tuition. He was stuck now, not only for the rest of that year, but for the 4 additional years it would take until he graduated from high school. 5 years in all, which is more time than many people served for armed robbery or manslaughter. Angie came into the dining room with dessert, and as Ferguson looked down at his bowl of chocolate pudding, he wondered why there wasn't a law that allowed children to divorce their parents. Because nothing had changed or ever would change. Because the old system of family governance was still intact after Ferguson's efforts to amend the Constitution had been voted down, the unfallen Ancien Régime continued to rule by reflex and ingrained whimsy. And so it was decreed that the vanquished malcontent should be rewarded with yet another summer at his beloved Camp Paradise, his 6th consecutive year in that parentless haven of ball fields, canoe expeditions, and the rowdy companionship of his New York friends. Not only was Ferguson about to leave his mother and father for 2 long months of respite and freedom, but standing beside him on the platform at Grand Central on the morning of his departure was Noah Marks, who was on his way up north for yet another summer as well. For Noah was back, and after missing the second half of the 1956 season and all 8 weeks of 1957, he had resumed his connection with Camp Paradise and was about to embark on his 4th straight session there in the company of his stepmother's nephew, also known as his step-cousin and friend, the now 14-year-old Ferguson, who at 5'7" stood half a head taller than Noah, who still went by the name of Harpo at camp. It was a curious story. Ferguson's Aunt Mildred had remained Noah's stepmother because she and Uncle Don had never bothered to divorce. And when Noah's father returned from his 18-month sojourn in Paris, where he had begun writing a biography of Montaigne, he moved back to his old address on Perry Street. Not into the 3rd-floor apartment he had previously shared with Mildred, however, but into a smaller, 2nd-floor studio that had been vacated during his absence and which Mildred had rented for him prior to his return. That was the new arrangement, after a year and a half of turmoil and indecision, punctuated by 3 trips to Paris when Mildred was on break from teaching at Brooklyn College, they had concluded that they couldn't live apart. On the other hand, they also understood that they were incapable of living together, at least not all the time, at least not as a conventionally married couple. And unless they allowed for sporadic interruptions of the domestic routine, they would end up devouring each other in a bloodbath of cannibalistic rage. Hence the compromise of the 2 apartments, the so-called escape hatch conciliation. For theirs was one of those impossible loves, a fraught mixture of passion and incompatibility, an electric storm field of equally charged negative and positive ions. And because Don and Mildred were both selfish and volatile and utterly devoted to each other, The wars they fought were never ending, except at those moments when Don moved downstairs into a second-floor apartment, and a new era of peace began. It was quite a muddle in Ferguson's opinion, but not one he dwelled on at any length, since all marriages in his experience were flawed in one way or another. The savage conflicts of Don and Mildred, as opposed to the weary indifference of his parents, but both marriages flawed just the same, not to mention his grandparents, who had barely spoken 50 words to each other in the past 10 years. And as far as he could tell, the only grown-up man or woman who seemed to take pleasure in the mere fact of being alive was his great-aunt Pearl, who no longer had a husband and would never have one again. Still in all, Ferguson was glad that Don and Mildred had been reunited, if not for their sakes, then at least for his own, since Don's return had brought Noah back into his life, and after an 18-month interval, during which they had been barred from each other's company by Noah's quasi-insane mother, Ferguson was astonished by how quickly they became friends again, as if the long separation had lasted no more than a matter of days. Noah was still all flap and fury, the fast-talking needler of yore, but far less combustible at 11 than he had been at 9. And as the boys staggered through late childhood into early adolescence, each one found support in what he perceived to be the other's strengths. For Noah, Ferguson was the handsome prince who excelled at everything he touched, the top dog who hit for the highest batting average and earned splendid marks at school, the one the girls liked, the one most looked up to by the other boys. And to be the cousin, friend, and confidant of such a person was an ennobling force in his life, which otherwise was a tormented life, the transitional life of a 14-year-old who fretted daily about his frizz-headed, gawky looks, about the disfiguring metal wires that had been bolted onto his teeth for the past year, about his appalling lack of physical grace. Ferguson knew how much Noah admired him, but he also knew that this admiration was misjudged and unwarranted, that Noah had turned him into a heroic, idealized being who in fact did not exist, whereas he, Ferguson, in the dark inner space where he actually lived, understood that Noah possessed a first-class mind and that when it came to the things that truly mattered, the young Mr. Marks was far more advanced than he was, at least one step ahead of him at every moment, often 2 steps, and occasionally 4 steps and even 10 steps. Noah was his pathfinder, the quick-moving scout who explored the woods for Ferguson and told him where the best hunting was. Books to read, music to listen to, jokes to laugh at, films to watch, ideas to think about. And now that Ferguson had ingested Candide and Bartleby, J.S. Bach and Muddy Waters, Modern Times and Grand Illusion, Gene Shepherd's late-night monologues and Mel Brooks' 2,000-year-old man, Notes of a Native Son, and the Communist Manifesto. No, Karl Marx wasn't a relative, and neither, alas, was Groucho. He couldn't help imagining how impoverished his life would have been without Noah. Anger and disappointment could take you just so far, he realized, but without curiosity, you were lost. So there they were in July 1961, about to set off for Camp Paradise, at the start of that eventful summer, when all the news from the outside world seemed to be bad news. The wall going up in Berlin. Ernest Hemingway blasting a bullet through his skull in the mountains of Idaho. Mobs of white racists attacking the Freedom Riders as they traveled on their buses through the South. Menace, despondency, and hatred. Abundant proof that rational men were not in charge of running the universe. And as Ferguson settled into the pleasant and familiar bustle of camp life, dribbling basketballs and stealing bases in the mornings and afternoons, listening to the barbs and blather of the boys in his cabin, exulting in the chance to be with Noah again, which above all meant being able to participate in a non-stop 2-month-long conversation with him, dancing in the evenings with the New York City girls he liked so much, the spirited and busty Carol Thalberg, the slender and thoughtful Anne Brodsky, and eventually the acne-ridden but exceptionally beautiful Denise Levinson, who was of one mind with him about slipping away from the post-dinner socials for intense mouth-and-tongue exercises in the back meadow. So many good things to be thankful for, and yet now that he was 14 and his head was filled with thoughts that wouldn't even have occurred to him just 6 months earlier, Ferguson was forever looking at himself in relation to distant, unknown others, wondering, for example, if he hadn't been kissing Denise at the precise moment when Hemingway was blowing his brains out in Idaho, or if, just as he was hitting a double in the game between Camp Paradise and Camp Greylock last Thursday, a Mississippi Klansman hadn't been driving his fist into the jaw of a skinny, short-haired freedom rider from Boston. One person kissed, another person punched, or else one person attending his mother's funeral at 11 o'clock in the morning on June 10, 1857, and at the same moment, on the same block, in the same city, another person holding her newborn child in her arms for the first time, the sorrow of the one occurring simultaneously with the joy of the other. And unless you were God, who was presumably everywhere and could see everything that was happening at any given moment, no one could possibly know that those two events were taking place at the same time, least of all the grieving son and the laughing mother. Was that why man had invented God, Ferguson asked himself, in order to overcome the limits of human perception by asserting the existence of an all-encompassing, all-powerful divine intelligence? Think of it this way, he said to Noah one afternoon as they were walking to the dining hall. You have to go somewhere in your car. It's an important errand, and you can't be late. There are two ways to get there, by the main road or the back road. It happens to be rush hour, and normally things are pretty clogged up on the main road at that time of day. But unless there's an accident or a breakdown, the traffic tends to move slowly and steadily, and chances are the trip will take you about 20 minutes, which would get you to your appointment just in time, on the dot, without a second to spare. The back road is a bit longer in terms of distance, but there are fewer cars to worry about, and if all goes well, you can count on a travel time of about 15 minutes. In principle, the back road is better than the main road, but there's also a hitch. It has only one lane going in each direction, and if you happen to run into a breakdown or an accident, you're liable to get stuck for a long time, which would make you late for your appointment. Hold on, Noah said. I need to know more about this appointment. Where am I going, and why is it so important to me? It doesn't matter, Ferguson replied. The car trip is just an example, a proposition, a way of talking about the thing I want to discuss with you, which has nothing to do with roads or appointments. But it does matter, Archie. Everything matters. Ferguson let out a long sigh and said, All right, you're going to a job interview. It's the job you've been dreaming about all your life. Paris correspondent for the Daily Planet. If you get the job, you'll be the happiest person in the world. If you don't, you'll go home and hang yourself. If it means that much to me, why would I leave at the last minute? Why not start the trip an hour earlier and make sure I won't be late? Because you can't. Your grandmother has died and you had to go to her funeral. Fair enough. It's what we call a momentous day. I've just spent 6 hours weeping for my grandmother, and now I'm in my car, heading for the job interview. Which road do you want me to take? Again, it doesn't matter. There are only two choices, the main road and the back road, and each one has its good points and bad points. Say you choose the main road and get your appointment on time. You won't think about your choice, will you? And if you go by the back road and get there in time, again, no sweat, and you'll never give it another thought for the rest of your life. But here's where it gets interesting. You take the main road. There's a three-car pileup. Traffic is stalled for more than an hour. As you sit there in your car, the only thing on your mind will be the back road and why you didn't go that way instead. You'll curse yourself for making the wrong choice. And yet how do you really know it was the wrong choice? Can you see the back road? Do you know what's happening on the back road? Has anyone told you that an enormous redwood tree has fallen across the back road and crushed a passing car, killing the driver of that car and holding up traffic for 3.5 hours? Has anyone looked at his watch and told you that if you had taken the back road, it would have been your car that was crushed and you who had been killed? Or else, no tree fell, and taking the main road was the wrong choice. Or else, you took the back road and the tree fell on the driver just in front of you. As you sit in your car wishing you had taken the main road, you know nothing about the three-car pileup that would have made you miss your appointment anyway. Or else, there was no three-car pileup, and taking the back road was the wrong choice. What's the point of all this, Archie? I'm saying you'll never know if you made the wrong choice or not. You would need to have all the facts before you knew, and the only way to get all the facts is to be in two places at the same time, which is impossible. And? And that's why people believe in God. Surely you jest, Monsieur Voltaire. Only God can see the main road and the back road at the same time, which means that only God can know if you made the right choice or the wrong choice. How do you know he knows? I don't, but that's the assumption people make. Unfortunately, God never tells us what he thinks. You could always write him a letter. True, but there wouldn't be any point. What's the problem? Can't afford the airmail postage? I don't have his address. There was a new boy in the cabin that year, the one first-timer among Ferguson's old comrades from summers past, a non-city boy who lived in the Westchester town of New Rochelle, which made him the only other suburban dweller in Ferguson's circle of acquaintances, less boisterous and verbally aggressive than the boys from New York, quiet in the way that Ferguson was quiet, but even more so, a boy who said almost nothing, and yet, when he did speak, the people within hearing distance found themselves paying close attention to his words. His name was Fetterman, Art Fetterman, universally known as Artie. And because Artie Fetterman was so close in sound to Archie Ferguson, the boys in the cabin often joked that they were long-lost brothers, identical twins who had been separated at birth. What made the joke funny was that it wasn't a real joke, but an anti-joke. A joke that made sense only if it was understood as a joke about the joke itself. For while Ferguson and Fetterman shared certain physical characteristics, similar in size and build, both with big hands and the lean, muscled bodies of young ball players, they bore little resemblance to each other beyond their common initials. Ferguson was dark and Fetterman was fair. Ferguson's eyes were gray-green and Fetterman's were brown. Their noses, ears, and mouths were all shaped differently, and no one seeing them together for the first time ever would have mistaken them for brothers, or even, for that matter, distant cousins. On the other hand, the boys in the cabin were no longer seeing them together for the first time, and as the days passed and they continued to observe the two AFs in action, perhaps they understood that the joke that was not a joke was something more than a joke. For even if it wasn't a question of two flesh-and-blood brothers, it was a question of friends, of two flesh-and-blood friends who were rapidly becoming as close as brothers. One of the odd things about being himself, Ferguson had discovered, was that there seemed to be several of him, that he wasn't just one person, but a collection of contradictory selves, and each time he was with a different person, he himself was different as well. With an outspoken extrovert like Noah, he felt quiet and closed in on himself. With a shy and guarded person like Anne Brodsky, he felt loud and crude, always talking too much in order to overcome the awkwardness of her long silences. Humorless people tended to transform him into a jokester. Quick-witted clowns made him feel dull and slow. Still other people seemed to possess the power to draw him into their orbit and make him act in the same way they did. Pugnacious Mark Dubinsky, with his endless opinions about politics and sports, would bring out the verbal battler in Ferguson. Dreamy Bob Cramer would make him feel fragile and unsure of himself. Artie Fetterman, on the other hand, made him feel calm, calm in a way no other person had ever made him feel. For being with the new boy brought the same sense of selfhood he felt when he was alone. If either one of the two AFs had been a slightly different person, they easily could have wound up as enemies. Ferguson in particular had every justification to resent the newcomer's arrival on the scene. for it turned out that Fetterman was better at sports than he was, and for the past 5 years, Ferguson had been the best, especially at baseball, which meant he had always played shortstop and batted fourth for the traveling team. But when Fetterman showed up for practice on the first day, it quickly became apparent that he had more range and a stronger arm than Ferguson, that his bat was faster and more powerful, and by the next day, when he hit 2 home runs and a double in an intra-squad game, eliminating any doubt that his first day's performance had been a fluke, Bill Rappaport, the 24-year-old coach of the team, pulled Ferguson aside and announced his decision. Fetterman was the new shortstop and cleanup hitter, and Ferguson was being switched over to third base and would bat one notch up in the order. "You understand why I have to do this, don't you?" Bill said. Ferguson nodded. Given the strength of the evidence, what else could he do but nod? "Nothing against you, Archie," Bill continued, "but this new kid is phenomenal." No matter how you looked at it, Bill's new lineup was a demotion, a small drop in the ranks, and it stung Ferguson to have lost his position as supreme commander of the Camp Paradise baseball army. But just as feelings were always feelings, subjectively true 100% of the time, facts were also facts, and in this case, the objective, unarguable fact was that Bill had made the right decision. Ferguson was the number 2 man now. The old boyhood dream of one day making it to the major leagues slowly dissolved into a gunky residue at the bottom of his stomach. It left a bitter taste for a while, but then he got over it. Fetterman was simply too good to want to compete with him. In the face of such a talent, the only proper response was to be thankful he was on your side. What made that talent so unusual, Ferguson felt, was that Fetterman was all but oblivious to it. No matter how earnestly he played, no matter how many games he won with last-inning hits or diving stops in the field, he never seemed to understand how much better he was than everyone else. Excelling at baseball was merely something he could do, and he accepted it in the same way he accepted the color of the sky or the roundness of the earth. A passion to do well, yes, but at the same time, indifference, even a touch of boredom. And whenever someone on the team remarked that he should think about turning pro after he finished high school, Fetterman would shake his head and laugh. Baseball was a fun thing to do, he'd say, but it was essentially meaningless, no more than kid stuff. And when he graduated from high school, his plan was to go on to college and study to become a scientist, either a physicist or a mathematician. He wasn't sure which one yet. There was something both lunkheaded and disarming about that response, Ferguson thought, which struck him as a typical example of what defined his almost namesake and set him apart from the others, since it was a foregone conclusion that all the boys would eventually go on to college. That was the world they lived in, the third-generation Jewish-American world in which all but the most feeble-minded were now expected to earn an undergraduate degree, if not a professional or advanced degree. But Fetterman didn't understand the nuances of what the others were saying to him. He failed to realize they weren't telling him he shouldn't go to college, but that he didn't have to go if he didn't want to, which meant they thought he was in a stronger position than they were, more in control of his own destiny. And because he was indeed an excellent student in math and science, and had every intention of going to college, he was teaching himself calculus that summer, for God's sake, and how many 14-year-olds could grasp the principles of calculus? He had ignored the compliment and given them a blunt, straight-from-the-heart answer that was so obvious and beside the point. Everyone knew he was studying calculus and was inevitably bound for college, then he needn't have said it at all. But that was one of the things Ferguson liked best about the other AF, his innocence, his unworldly remove from the ironies and contradictions of the society he belonged to. Everyone else seemed to be trapped in the throes of a perpetual agitation, a chaos of clashing impulses and turbulent inconsistencies. But Fetterman was still, pensive, and apparently at peace with himself. So locked into his own thoughts and his own way of doing things that he paid little attention to the noise around him. An uncontaminated being, Ferguson sometimes thought. So pure and rigorously himself that it was often difficult to make sense of him. Which was no doubt why he and Noah had formed such different impressions of their new cabin mate. Noah was willing to grant that Fetterman was both highly intelligent and a superb ballplayer, but he was too sincere for his taste, too lacking in the humor department to qualify as good company, and the stillness that emanated from him, which had such a calming effect on Ferguson, was altogether unnerving to Noah, who felt that Fetterman was something less than fully human, a weird ghosty boy, as he once put it, a specter who had been born with parts of his brain missing. Ferguson understood what Noah was trying to express with those comments, but he didn't agree with him. Fetterman was different, that was all, a person who lived on a separate plane from the others, and what Noah saw as weaknesses of character, Fetterman's shyness with girls, his inability to tell a joke, his reluctance to argue with anyone. Ferguson tended to read as strengths, for he spent more time with Fetterman than Noah did, and he understood that what Noah perceived as shallowness or even emptiness was in fact depth, a largeness of soul that was not present in anyone else he knew. The problem was that Fetterman didn't do well in groups, whereas alone with a single counterpart, he was a different person. And now that 3 weeks had gone by, and the two AFs had walked back and forth to the baseball field together dozens of times, Ferguson had come to know that other person, or at least was beginning to know him, and the thing that impressed him most about Fetterman was how observant he was, how remarkably attuned his senses were to the world around him, and whenever he pointed to a cloud passing overhead, or to a bee alighting on the stamen of a flower, or identified the call of an invisible bird crying out from the woods, Ferguson felt he was seeing and hearing those things for the first time, that without his friend to alert him to the presence of those things, he never would have known they were there. For walking with Fetterman was above all an exercise in the art of paying attention, and paying attention, Ferguson discovered, was the first step in learning how to be alive. Then came the exceptionally warm Thursday afternoon toward the end of the month, more or less the midpoint of the summer. Just 2 days before the start of Parents' Weekend, with a basketball-baseball doubleheader scheduled for Saturday morning and afternoon against much-feared and much-hated rival Camp Scatico, whose teams would be visiting Camp Paradise for the day, games that would be watched by the mothers and fathers of the Paradise boys, the roly-poly women in their sleeveless cotton dresses, the chunky men in their Bermuda shorts, the sleek and formerly sleek women in their pedal-pusher slacks and stiletto heels, the men with thinning hair in their white business shirts with the sleeves rolled up to the elbow. It was the biggest sports day of the summer, which would be followed in the evening by a performance of the old Marx Brothers play, The Coconuts, which had been turned into their first film in 1929. And bizarrely, and yet most fittingly, Noah, who was widely known throughout the camp as Harpo, had been cast in the role of Groucho, a part for which his talents were far better suited. And not only was Ferguson looking forward to the games he would be involved in 2 days hence, he couldn't wait to see his cousin walk the Groucho walk as he pranced about the stage with a cigar wedged between the second and third fingers of his right hand and a grease paint mustache smeared across the skin between his nose and upper lip. So much anticipation leading up to the events of that day. And because Camp Paradise was almost certain to lose the basketball game, they had been trounced on their visit to Camp Scatico 10 days earlier. Bill Rappaport was determined to repeat their victory in baseball, and to that end he had put the boys through several grueling practices over the past days, with endless precision drills in fundamentals, bunting, hitting the cutoff man, holding runners on base, and strenuous calisthenic exercises to keep them in shape, push-ups, sit-ups, wind sprints, laps around the field. And on that particular Thursday in late July, which was the warmest, muggiest day that had fallen upon the camp all summer, Ferguson's body had been awash in sweat throughout the entire practice. And now that the two-hour session was over, and he and Fetterman were walking back to the cabin, where they would be changing into their bathing suits for the obligatory pre-dinner swim, he felt exhausted from his exertions on the field, sapped of energy, as he put it to Fetterman, as if each one of his legs weighed 200 pounds. And even the normally indefatigable New Rochelle calculus boy admitted that he, too, was feeling rather pooped. About halfway to the cabin, Ferguson began talking about the book he had finished reading during the post-lunch rest hour, Miss Lonely Hearts, a tiny novel by Nathaniel West that had been included by his Aunt Mildred in her annual package of summer books for him. And just as he was starting to explain that Miss Lonely Hearts was in fact a man, a journalist writing in the voice of a woman for an advice column to the Lovelorn, he heard Fetterman emit a small, muffled noise, something that sounded like the word, "Oh." And when he swiveled his head to the right and looked at his friends, he saw that Fetterman was staggering, as if he had been overcome by a fit of dizziness. And before Ferguson could ask him what was wrong, Fetterman's knees buckled and he slowly fell to the ground. Ferguson assumed it was a joke, that after all the talk about how tired they were, Fetterman had gotten it into his head to do a comic demonstration of what happens to a body after too much exercise on hot and humid summer days. But the laugh Ferguson was expecting to hear didn't come. For the truth was that Artie wasn't a person who trafficked in jokes, and as Ferguson bent down to examine his friend's face, he was startled to see that his eyes were neither open nor closed, but half open, half closed, with only the whites visible, as if his eyes had rolled up into his head, which seemed to suggest that he had passed out. So Ferguson began to tap Fetterman's cheeks with his fingers, first tapping and then pinching the cheeks, as he told him to wake up, as if a few taps and a few pinches would be enough to rouse him to consciousness. But when Fetterman didn't respond, when his head lulled back and forth as Ferguson began to shake his shoulders and his inert eyelids refused to open or shut or even flutter with the smallest sign of life, Ferguson started to grow afraid. And so he pressed his ear against Fetterman's chest in order to listen to the beating of his heart, in order to feel his ribcage rising and falling as the air went in and out of his lungs. But there was no heartbeat. There was no breath. And an instant later, Ferguson stood up and began to howl. "Help me! Help me! Someone, please! Someone, help me!" Brain aneurysm. That was the official cause of death, someone said. And since the Columbia County Medical Examiner performed the autopsy himself, those were the words he inscribed on Fetterman's death certificate. Brain aneurysm. Ferguson knew what a brain was, but it was the first time he had come across the word aneurysm. So he walked over to the head counselor's office and looked it up in the Webster's Collegiate Dictionary that sat on the top shelf of the bookcase. Quote, "A permanent abnormal blood-filled dilation of an artery, resulting from disease of the vessel wall." The games with Camp Scatico were canceled until further notice. The Marx Brothers comedy would be held back until sometime the following month. The family songfest, scheduled for Sunday morning, was erased from the calendar. At the all-camp gathering that convened in the big barn after dinner on Thursday, half the children wept, many of whom had never even known Fetterman. Jack Feldman, the head counselor, told the boys and girls that the ways of God were incomprehensible, beyond the grasp of human understanding. Bill Rappaport blamed himself for Fetterman's collapse. He had pushed the team too hard, he told Ferguson. He had put everyone in danger with those punishing workouts in that intolerable heat and humidity. What the fuck had he been thinking? Ferguson remembered the words from the dictionary. Permanent, abnormal, blood-filled, disease. "No, Bill," he said. "It was bound to happen sooner or later. Artie was walking around with a time bomb in his head. It's just that no one knew about it. Not him, not his parents, not one doctor who ever examined him. He had to die before anyone found out that the time bomb had been there his whole life." During rest hour on Friday afternoon, his name was announced over the loudspeaker. Archie Ferguson, the voice of the camp secretary, said, "Archie Ferguson, please come to the main office. You have a telephone call." It was his mother. "Such a terrible thing, Archie," she said. "I feel so sorry for that boy, for you, for everyone." "It wasn't just a terrible thing," Ferguson replied. "It was the worst thing that had ever happened." A long pause followed on the other end of the line, and then his mother said that she had just received a call from Artie's mother. An unexpected call, of course. An excruciating call, of course. But purely for the purpose of inviting Ferguson to attend the funeral in New Rochelle on Sunday, assuming he could get permission to leave the camp, and assuming he felt up to going. "I don't understand," Ferguson said. "No one else is invited. Why me?" His mother explained that Mrs. Fetterman had been reading and rereading the letters her son had sent home from camp, and in nearly all of them, Ferguson had been mentioned, often several times in the space of 3 or 4 paragraphs. "Archie is my best friend," his mother said, quoting a passage that had been read to her over the phone. "The best friend I've ever had." And again, "Archie is such a good person. It makes me happy just to be near him." And again, "Archie is the closest thing I've ever had to a brother." Another long pause, and then Ferguson said, in a voice so quiet he could barely hear his own words, "That's how I felt about Artie." It was settled then. There would be no weekend visit from his parents. Instead, Ferguson would take the train down to New York in the morning. His mother would meet him at Grand Central Station. He would spend the night in the city at her parents' apartment, and the next morning the two of them would drive up to New Rochelle together. Not one to ignore the exigencies of public occasions, his mother promised to carry along clothes for him to wear at the funeral. His white shirt, jacket and tie, his black shoes, black socks, and charcoal gray pants. She said, "Have you grown much since you've been up there, Archie?" "I'm not sure," Ferguson answered. "Maybe a little." "I'm wondering if those things will still fit you." "Does it matter?" "Maybe yes, maybe no. If the buttons pop off your shirt, we can always buy some new clothes tomorrow." The buttons didn't pop off, but the shirt was too small for him now, as was everything else except the tie. What a nuisance to go out shopping in 94-degree weather, he thought, trudging through the streets of the broiling city, because he'd grown 2.5 inches since the spring. But he couldn't go to New Rochelle in his camp jeans and tennis shoes, and so off he went with his mother to Macy's, prowling the men's department for more than an hour in search of something decent to wear. Without question, the most boring activity on earth, even in the best of times, which these times most definitely were not, and so little was his heart in what they were doing that he allowed his mother to make all the decisions, selecting this shirt, this jacket, and this pair of pants for him. And yet, as he would soon learn, how preferable was the boredom of shopping to the wretched hopelessness of sitting in the synagogue the next day. The hot sanctuary crowded with more than 200 people. Artie's mother and father, his 12-year-old sister, his 4 grandparents, his aunts and uncles, his boy and girl cousins, his friends from school, his various teachers going all the way back to kindergarten, his friends and coaches from the sports teams he had played on, friends of the family, friends of the family, a mob of people baking in that airless room, as tears spurted from clenched eyes, and men and women sobbed, as boys and girls sobbed, and there was the rabbi at the pulpit reciting prayers in both Hebrew and English. None of that Christian claptrap about going to a better place. No fairy tale afterlife for Ferguson and his people. These were the Jews, the demented, defiant Jews, and for them there was only one life and one place, this life and this earth. And the only way to look at death was to praise God, to praise the power of God, even when the death belonged to a 14-year-old boy. To praise their fucking God until their eyes fell out of their heads and their balls fell off their bodies and their hearts shriveled inside them. At the cemetery, as the casket was being lowered into the ground, Artie's father tried to jump into his son's grave. It took four men to pull him back, and when he tried to break free of them and do it again, the biggest of the four, who turned out to be his younger brother, put him in a headlock and wrestled him to the ground. At the house after the burial, Artie's mother, a tall woman with thick legs and broad hips, threw her arms around Ferguson and told him he would always be part of the family. For the next 2 hours, he sat on the sofa in the living room, talking to Artie's little sister, whose name was Celia. He wanted to tell her that he was her brother now, that he would go on being her brother for as long as he lived, but he couldn't find the courage to push the words out of his mouth. Summer came to a close. Another school year began, and in mid-September, Ferguson started writing a short story, which slowly grew into a rather long story by the time he finished it in the days before Thanksgiving. He suspected it had been inspired by the joke that was not a joke about the two AFs, but he wasn't quite sure, since the story had come to him out of nowhere as a fully formed idea. And yet, somehow or other, Fetterman must have been in there too, given that Fetterman was always with him now, would always be with him from now on. Not Archie and Artie, as he had been tempted to use at first, but Hank and Frank. Those were the names of the principal characters. A rhyming pair rather than an assonant pair, but a lifelong pair for all that. In this case, a pair of shoes, which was how this story got its title. Soulmates, S-O-L-E. Hank and Frank, the left shoe and the right shoe, meet for the first time in the factory where they were made, arbitrarily thrown together when the last person on the assembly line puts them into the same shoebox. They are a sturdy, well-crafted pair of brown leather lace-ups, commonly known as brogans. And while their personalities are slightly different, Hank tends to be anxious and introspective, while Frank is blunt and fearless, they are not different in the way that Laurel and Hardy are different, for example, or Heckle and Jekyll, or Abbott and Costello, but different perhaps in the way that Ferguson and Fetterman had been different. Two peas from the same pod, yet by no means identical. Neither one of them is happy in the box. They are still strangers at this point, and not only is it dark and stuffy in there, they have been jammed up against each other in a most intimate and compromising way, which leads to some unfriendly bickering at first. But then Frank tells Hank to get a grip on himself and settle down. They're stuck with each other, whether they like it or not. And Hank, understanding that he has no choice but to make the best of a bad situation, apologizes for having gotten them off on the wrong foot. To which Frank says, "Is that supposed to be funny?" Meaning he didn't find the remark funny at all. And so Hank comes back at him by dropping his voice and speaking in a broad southern accent. "I shoo hope so, Brother Brogan. Can't live this life without no funnies, can we?" The box containing Hank and Frank is put on a truck and driven to New York City, where it ends up in the back room of the Florsheim shoe store on Madison Avenue. One more box added to the hundreds of boxes stacked on shelves waiting to be sold. That is their destiny, to be sold, to be deboxed by a man with size 11 feet and led away from the back room of that store forever. And Hank and Frank are impatient to begin their lives, to be out in the open air, walking with their master. Frank is confident about their chances for a quick sale. They're an everyday sort of pair, he tells Hank, not some novelty item like patent leather dress shoes or Santa Claus slippers or fleece-lined snow boots. And since everyday shoes are the ones most in demand, it shouldn't be long before they can say goodbye to this dreary, stinking box of theirs. "Maybe so," Hank says, "but if Frank wants to talk about odds and statistics, he should think about the number 11. Size 11 worries him. It's much bigger than average, and who knows how long they'll have to wait before Mr. Bigfoot walks in and asks to try them on. He'd be much happier with an 8 or a 9, he says. That's what most men wear, and most means faster. The bigger the shoe, the longer it's going to take, and size 11 is one hell of a big shoe. Just be glad we're not a 12 or 13, Frank says. "I am," Hank replies. "I'm also glad we're not a 6, but I'm not glad we're an 11. After 3 days and three nights on the shelf, a bleak span that only prolongs their doubts and febrile calculations about when and how they will be rescued, if indeed they will be rescued at all, a clerk finally comes in the next morning, pulls out their box from the tower of boxes they were consigned to, and carries them into the showroom at the front of the store. A customer is interested. The clerk removes the lid from the box, and in that first moment, when the light of the world shines upon them, Hank and Frank start to tingle with joy. A joy so vast and intoxicating that it spreads all the way to the tips of their laces. They can see again, see for the first time since the factory worker put them in their box, and now that the clerk is taking them out of the box and putting them on the floor in front of the seated customer, Frank says to Hank, "I think we're in business, pal," to which Hank responds, "I certainly hope so." Note: at no point in the story does Ferguson address the question of how shoes can talk, in spite of the fact that all lace-up shoes are equipped with tongues. If it is a problem, he solves the problem by refusing to consider it. Nevertheless, the language spoken by Hank and Frank is apparently inaudible to human beings, since the two of them carry on conversations wherever and whenever they like, with no fear of being overheard, at least not by living people. In the presence of other shoes, however, they must be more circumspect, for all shoes in the story speak shoe. As it happened, none of Ferguson's early readers objected to his use of that absurd, make-believe language. They all seemed to go along with it as a legitimate case of poetic license, but several people thought he had gone too far by giving Hank and Frank the ability to see. "Shoes are blind," one person said. "Everybody knows that. How on earth can shoes possibly see?" The 14-year-old author paused for a moment, shrugged his shoulders, and said, "With their eyelets, of course. How else?" The customer is a big man, a great hulking fellow of broad girth, with a pair of swollen ankles and the moist, pallid skin of someone who might or might not be suffering from diabetes or heart trouble. Not an ideal master, perhaps, but as Hank and Frank have told each other countless times over the past 3 days, shoes can't choose. They must submit to the will of the person who buys them, no matter who that person happens to be. For their job is to protect feet, any and all feet, under any and all circumstances. And whether those feet belong to a madman or a saint, shoes must perform that job in perfect compliance with the wishes of their master. Still, it is an important moment for the newly manufactured Brogans, so young and gleaming in the stiffness of their cowhide uppers and untrammeled soles. For this is the moment when they will at last begin their lives as fully functioning shoes. And as the clerk slips Hank onto the customer's left foot and then slips Frank onto the right, they both groan with pleasure, astonished by how good it feels to have a foot inside them. And then, miraculously, the pleasure only increases as the laces are tightened and the two ends are knotted into a crisp, firm bow. "Seems to be a good fit," the clerk says to the customer. "Would you like to have a look in the mirror?" And so it is that Hank and Frank are able to see themselves together for the first time, by looking into the mirror as the fat man looks into the mirror as well. "What a handsome pair we are," Frank says, and for once Hank is in accord with him. "The finest Brogans ever made," he says. Or, as the bard might have put it, "the very kings of cobbledom." While Hank and Frank are admiring themselves in the mirror, however, the fat man is beginning to shake his head. "I'm not sure," he says to the clerk. "They look a bit clunky to me." "A man of your bulk needs a hearty shoe," the clerk replies, delivering his words in a matter-of-fact tone so as not to offend the customer. "Of course," the fat man mutters, "that goes without saying, doesn't it? But that doesn't mean I have to walk around in these clodhoppers." "They're classics, sir," the clerk says dryly. "Cop shoes, that's what they look like to me," the fat man says. "Shoes for a plainclothes cop." After a considerable pause, the clerk clears his throat and says, "May I suggest we look at something else? A pair of wingtips, perhaps?" "Yeah, wingtips," the customer says, nodding in agreement. "That's the word I was looking for. Not Brogans, wingtips." Hank and Frank are put back in their box, and a few moments later they are lifted off the floor by a pair of invisible hands and carried back to the back room, where they once again join the ranks of the unsold. Hank is burning with indignation. The fat man's comments have incensed him, and as he spits out the words clunky and clodhopper for the 43rd time in the past hour, Frank finally speaks up and implores him to stop. "Don't you realize how lucky we are?" he says. "Not only was that man a numbskull, he was an obese numbskull, and the last thing we want is to be saddled with too much heft. If old Mr. Chunkowitz didn't weigh 300 pounds, he must have been a good 260 or 270. And just imagine the day-to-day wear and tear of walking around with a mountain like that on top of us. Little by little, we would have been crushed, used up before our time, junked before we'd even had a chance to live. There might not be a lot of featherweights who wear size 11, but at least we can hope for someone who's lean and fit, a man with a light and even step. No waddlers or ploddlers for us, Hank. We deserve the best because we're classics." Two more misses follow over the next 3 days. One of them a near miss, a man who falls in love with them but discovers he needs a size 10.5. And the other one a dud from the word go. A scowling teenage giant who mocks his mother for making him try on such ugly gunboats. And the wait goes on, so dispiriting in its languorous monotony that Hank and Frank begin to wonder if they aren't doomed to remain on the shelf forever. Unwanted, out of style, forgotten. Then, 3 full days after the gunboat insult, when all hope has disappeared from their hearts, a customer walks into the store. A 30-year-old man named Abner Quine, 6 feet tall and a trim 170 pounds, a size 11, who not only is looking for a pair of Brogans, but will not settle for anything but a pair of Brogans. And so Hank and Frank are taken off the shelf for the 4th time, which turns out to be the last time, the end of their fretful week in black shoebox limbo. For when Abner Quine sticks his feet into them and walks around the store to test them out, he says to the clerk, "Excellent, they're just what I wanted." And the two soulmates have finally found their master. Does it make any difference that Quine turns out to be a cop? Not really, not in the long run it doesn't. But after Hank and Frank were rejected by the fat customer for looking like a pair of cop shoes, it is something of a sore point with them. And rather than laugh at the coincidence, they feel hurt and bewildered. For if Brogans are the quintessential cop shoe, then it would seem they were fated all along to be worn by a flatfoot, a figure of immense ridicule in popular lore, and to be the shoe of preference for the flat feet of the world, that is, the very embodiment of flat-footedness, means there must be something ridiculous about them as well. "Let's face it," Hank says, "we weren't built for tuxedos and wild nights out on the town." "Maybe not," Frank replies, "but we're solid and dependable. Like 2 tanks. Well, who wants to be a sports car anyway?" "Cop shoes, Frank. That's what we are. The lowest of the low." "But look at our cop, Hank. What a fine figure of a man he is. And he wants us. Low or not, he wants us. And that's good enough for me." The tough, fast-walking Abner Quine has recently been promoted to the rank of detective. He has traded in his nightstick and patrolman's gear for a couple of business suits, a woolen one for the winter, a lightweight drip-dry for the summer, and has splurged on an expensive pair of shoes at Florsheim's, Hank and Frank, which he intends to wear for his detective work every day the year round, regardless of the weather. Quine lives alone in a small one-bedroom apartment in Hell's Kitchen. Not the best of neighborhoods in 1961, but the rent is low and his precinct house is just 4 blocks away. And even though the apartment is often less than clean, the detective has little appetite for housework. Hank and Frank are impressed by how well he takes care of them. Though young in age, their master is a man of the old school, and he treats his shoes with respect, methodically undoing the laces at night and leaving them on the floor beside his bed rather than kicking them off and or shutting them up in the closet, since shoes like to be near their master at all times, even when they are not on duty. And kicking off shoes without untying the laces can cause severe structural damage over the long haul. Quine tends to be busy and distracted while at work on his cases, robberies mostly. But let anything fall on either one of his shoes, whether a white splat of pigeon shit or a red blob of ketchup, and he is quick to remove the offending substance with one of the Kleenex tissues he carries in his right front pocket. Best of all, there are his frequent jaunts to Penn Station to consult with his prime snitch, an old black man named Moss, who happens to run the shoeshine stand in the main hall. And as Quine plunks himself down in the chair to get the latest dope from Moss, more often than not he will ask for a shine to cover up the true purpose of his visit, thus killing two birds with one stone, as it were, doing his job and caring for his brogans. And Hank and Frank are the happy beneficiaries of this ruse, for Moss is an expert, with the fastest, most agile hands in the business, and to be rubbed by his cloths and massaged by his brushes is an unsurpassed pleasure for everyday shoes like Hank and Frank, a swooning plunge into the depths of footwear sensuality. And once they have been buffed and boffed by Moss's sure hands, they end up spanking clean and waterproofed as well, winners on all fronts. It is a good life, then, about the best life they could have hoped for. But good must not be mistaken for easy, since it is the lot of shoes to work hard, even under the most positive circumstances, particularly in a place like New York, where a soul can go for months without stepping on a single tuft of grass or the tiniest patch of soft ground, where the extremes of hot and cold can cause havoc to the long-term health of leathery things, not to mention the damage wrought by downpours and snowfalls, of inadvertent missteps into puddles and drifts, of repeated dousings and drenchings, all the indignities that are visited upon them when the weather turns wet and foul, many of which could be avoided if their conscientious master were even more conscientious. But Quine is not a man who believes in rubbers or galoshes, and even in the heaviest blizzards, he has no truck with snow boots, preferring at all times the company of his beleaguered brogans, who are both honored by his trust in them and vexed by his thoughtlessness. Pounding the pavement, day in and day out, that is what Quine does, and therefore that is what Hank and Frank do as well. If there is any consolation in having their heels and soles worn down by the steady, abrasive interactions of leather and asphalt, it is that the two of them are in it together, brothers sharing their fate as one. Like most brothers, however, they have their moments of discord and petulance, their feuds and hot-tempered outbursts, for even if they are attached to one man's body, they themselves are two, and each one's relationship to that body is slightly different, since Quine's left foot and right foot are not always doing the same thing at the same time. Sitting in chairs, for example, as a left-handed person, he tends to cross his left leg over his right leg far more often than his right leg over his left, and few sensations are more enjoyable than feeling yourself being lifted into the air, of quitting the ground for a while and having your soul bared to the world. And because Hank is the left shoe and consequently is able to enjoy this experience more often than Frank, Frank harbors a certain resentment toward Hank, which he mostly struggles to suppress, but sometimes the liftoff puts Hank in such buoyant spirits that he can't stop himself from rubbing it in, laughing from his high perch as he dangles to the right of the master's right knee and calling out to Frank, "How's the weather down there, Frankie boy?" At which point Frank will inevitably lose his composure, telling Hank to butt out and mind his own business. At the same time, Frank often pities Hank for being the left shoe of a left-handed man, since Quine generally takes his first step with his left foot. And whenever they pause for a red light on rainy or snowy days, the first step across the street is always the most perilous one, the often catastrophic fording of the gutter. And how many times has Hank been dunked in puddles and immersed in soaking mounds of slush when he himself has remained dry? Too many times to count. Frank rarely laughs in the face of his brother's humiliations and near drownings, but sometimes, when he is in a particularly sour mood, he just can't help himself. Still in all, in spite of their occasional spats and misunderstandings, They have become the best of friends, and whenever they look at the brogans worn by their master's partner, a pair of grizzle guts named Ed and Fred, all shoe couples in Ferguson's story have rhyming names, Hank and Frank know how blessed they are to have fallen in with an upstanding sort like Abner Quine, rather than the slovenly thug he works with, Walter Benton, who seems happiest with his job when he's punching out suspects in the interrogation room or kicking them in the back with his shoes. Ed and Fred have done this dirty work for him often enough over the years to have been brutalized by it, and they have turned into an ordinary pair of low-life cruds, so cynical and disgusted with the world that they haven't even talked to each other for close to a year, not because they don't get along anymore, but simply because they can't be bothered. On top of that, Ed and Fred are beginning to fall apart, for Benton is a neglectful master as well as a stupid one, and he has allowed the heels of his shoes to wear down without replacing them, has done nothing about the hole developing in Ed's underbottom or the cracked leather skin in the toe crease of Fred's upper. And not once in all the time that Hank and Frank have known those ratty buggers, Hank's phrase for them, have they ever been polished. By contrast, Hank and Frank are polished twice a week, and in the 2 years they have been serving their master, they have each been given 4 new heels and 2 new soles. They still feel young, whereas Ed and Fred, who went on the job only 6 months before they did, are old. So old now, they're just about finished and ready to be junked. Because they are work shoes, they rarely get to accompany their master when he steps out with the ladies. The pursuit of love requires something less homely and down-to-earth than brogans. So Hank and Frank are cast aside in favor of Abner Q's triple-eyelided dress shoes, or his black alligator slip-ons, which always fills them with disappointment, not only because they dread being left alone in the dark, but because they have been with Quine on several of his amorous excursions, when he was too pressed to go home after work and change, and they know how much fun those outings can be, especially when the master spends the night in a woman's bed, which means that Hank and Frank get to spend the night on the floor beside the bed, and because it is the woman's apartment, the women's shoes are there as well, most often right next to them. And how raucous and jolly it was the first time, when they chatted and laughed and sang songs with Flora and Nora, an adorable pair of red satin high heels, and all the other times since then in a different woman's apartment, a big blonde the master calls either Alice or Darling, cavorting in her place on Greenwich Street, with a pair of black pumps named Leah and Mia, and a pair of penny loafers named Molly and Dolly. And how those girls carried on and giggled when they saw the master take off his clothes and strip down to the altogether, and how they gawked when they saw the ample breasts of their mistress bouncing up and down in the throes of love. Such splendid times they were, so scintillating when compared to the drab world of sweaty criminals and judges in black robes, and all the more precious to Hank and Frank for having been so few. Months go by, and it becomes more and more apparent to them that Alice is the one. Not only has the master stopped seeing other women, but most of his spare time is now spent with her, his beloved Darling, who has rapidly acquired several other names as well, among them Angel, Sweetheart, Gorgeous, and Monkey Face, signs of an ever-increasing intimacy that leads to the inevitable moment in late May when, sitting on a bench in Central Park with Alice, Quine at last pops the big question. Because it is a work day, Hank and Frank are there to witness the proposal, and they are more than encouraged by Alice's tender response. "I'll do everything to make you happy, my love," which seems to suggest they will be happy too, as happy with their new arrangement as they have been with the old. What Hank and Frank have failed to understand, however, is that marriage changes everything. It isn't just a question of two people deciding to live together. It's the beginning of a long struggle that pits one partner's will against the will of the other partner. And although the husband often appears to have the upper hand, it is the wife who is ultimately in control. The newlyweds abandon their respective apartments in Hell's Kitchen and Greenwich Village and take up residence in a larger, more comfortable place on West 25th Street. Since Alice has left her secretarial job in the DA's office, she is in charge of all household affairs, and while she routinely asks her husband for his opinion about the new curtain she wants to buy, the new rug she is planning to put in the living room, the new chair she is dreaming about for the dining room table, Quine's response is always the same. Whatever you want, babe, it's your call. Which means, in effect, that Alice makes all the decisions. But no matter, think Hank and Frank, Alice might be the ruler of the roost now, but they still get to spend their days with a master, pounding the pavement in search of crooks, grilling suspects in the interrogation room, appearing in court to testify at trials, following up leads on the telephone, typing reports, running down alleys whenever a bad guy is foolish enough to bolt, going to Penn Station for their twice-weekly buffings from Moss, and now that Benton has given Ed and Fred the old heave-ho, they have a new pair of associates to work with, Ned and Ted, surly customers to be sure, but not half as bad as the recently departed ratty buggers, which would suggest that, while many things are different now, the essential things are the same, perhaps even slightly better, than they were before. Or so Hank and Frank tell themselves, but what they don't know, and what their complacency prevents them from grasping, is that sweet-voiced Alice is on a mission, and her efforts to improve the master's life will not stop at curtains and rugs. Within 3 months of the wedding ceremony, she is forging on into the realm of her husband's clothes, in particular the clothes he wears at work, which she contends are too dull and shabby for a man who is destined to become a captain one day. And though Quine responds somewhat defensively at first, saying that his suits are good enough, more than adequate for the kind of job he does, Alice wears down his resistance by telling him how handsome he is, and what a dashing figure he'd cut in a top-of-the-line outfit. Both flattered and annoyed by her compliments, the master makes a witless crack about how money doesn't grow on trees, but he knows he has lost the battle, and on his next day off, he reluctantly follows his wife to a men's store on Madison Avenue, where his wardrobe is refurbished with a couple of new suits, 4 white shirts, and 6 of the skinny ties that are now in fashion. 3 mornings later, as the master dons one of those new suits before heading off to work, Alice breaks into a broad smile and tells him how impressive he looks. But then, before he can get a word out of his mouth, she glances down at his feet and says, "I'm afraid we'll have to do something about those shoes." "What's wrong with them?" Quine asks, beginning to show some irritation. "Nothing really," she says. "They're just old, that's all, and they don't go with the suit." "That's ridiculous. They're the best pair of shoes I've ever owned. I bought them at Florsheim's the day after my promotion, and I've been wearing them ever since. They're my lucky shoes, Angel. 3 years on the job, and in all that time, not one shot fired at me, not one punch thrown at my face, not a single bruise anywhere on my body." "That's just it, Abner. 3 years is a long time." "Not for a pair of brogans like these. They're not even fully broken in yet." Alice purses her lips, cocks her head, and playfully strokes her chin, as if trying to assess the shoes with the solemn detachment of a philosopher. At last she says, "Too clunky. The suit makes you look like an important man, but the shoes make you look like a cop." "But that's what I am. A cop. A goddamn flatfoot." "Just because you're a cop, that doesn't mean you have to look like a cop. The shoes give you away, Abner. You walk into a room, and everyone thinks, there's a cop. With the right pair of shoes, they'd never even guess." Hank and Frank wait for the master to speak up for them, to say a few more words in their defense. But Quine says nothing, answering Alice's remark with an inscrutable grunt. And a moment later, they are traveling with him as he walks to the front door of the apartment and leaves for work. The day is no different from any other day, nor is the next day any different from the day that preceded it, and Hank and Frank begin to hope the conversation with Alice was no more than a false alarm, that her harsh judgments about their value to the master are not shared by Quine himself, that the whole nasty business will blow away like a thin passing cloud. Then it is Saturday, another day off from police work, and out goes Quine with their new enemy, the obtrusive, opinionated Alice, out in his weekend loafers as they stand beside the bed and wait for the couple to return, never once suspecting that they are about to be betrayed by the man they have served so loyally for the past 3 years, and when the master comes back later that afternoon and tries on his new pair of Oxfords, Hank and Frank suddenly understand that they have been booted out and dismissed, purged by the upstart regime that has taken over the household, and because they have no recourse, no tribunal in which to lodge a complaint or present their side of the story, their lives are over and done with, stomped out by the palace coup that otherwise goes by the name of marriage. "What do you think?" Quine asks Alice as he finishes lacing the Oxfords and stands up from the bed. "Beautiful," she says. "The best of the best, Abner." As Quine walks around the room, acquainting his feet with the spring and texture of his new workday companions, Alice points to Hank and Frank and says, "What should I do with these old fogies?" "I don't know. Put them in the closet." "You don't want me to throw them out?" "No, put them in the closet. You never know when I might need them again." So Alice puts Hank and Frank in the closet, and while the master's parting words seem to offer some hope that they will be recalled to duty one day, months pass without any changes, and little by little they resign themselves to the fact that the master will never slip his feet into them again. The two Brogans are bitter about their enforced retirement, and all through their early weeks in the closet they talk about how cruelly they have been treated, wailing forth their grievances in long, foul-mouthed diatribes against the master and his wife. Not that this moaning and groaning does them any good, of course, and as dust begins to settle upon them, and as they begin to understand that the closet is their world now, that they will never leave it until the day they are junked, they give up their complaining and start to talk about the past, preferring to relive the old days instead of dwelling on the miseries of the present, and how good it is to remember their adventures with the master when they were young and vigorous and had their place in the world, how pleasant it is to recall the weathers they walked in, the myriad sensations of being outdoors in the fluctuating airs of planet Earth, the sense of purpose that had been given to them by belonging to the bigness of human life. More months go by, and their reminiscing slowly comes to an end, for it is becoming difficult to talk now, difficult even to remember, not because Hank and Frank are sinking into old age, but because they have been cast aside, and shoes that are no longer taken care of go downhill rapidly. Their exteriors dry up and crack when they cease to be shined and polished. Their interiors stiffen when human feet no longer enter them to provide the oils and perspiration necessary to keep them soft and pliable. And slowly but surely, cast-aside shoes begin to resemble blocks of wood. And wood is a substance incapable of thinking or speaking or remembering. And now that Hank and Frank have come to resemble two blocks of wood, they are nearly comatose, living in a shadow world of black voids and barely flickering candle flames. And so insensitive have their bodies become during their long incarceration that they feel nothing when the Quine's three-year-old son Timothy slips his feet into them one afternoon and clomps around the apartment laughing. And when his mother sees his little feet inside those enormous comatose shoes, she starts laughing as well. "What are you doing, Timmy?" she asks. "I'm pretending to be Daddy," he says. And then his mother shakes her head and frowns, telling the boy she'll give him a nicer pair of big shoes to play with. Those Brogans are so filthy and used up that it's time to get rid of them. How fortunate it is that Hank and Frank can no longer hear anything or feel anything. For once Alice has given her son his father's current pair of dress shoes, she picks up Hank and Frank with her left hand, puts her right hand on top of Timmy's head, and then leads him out into the hall toward the incinerator chute, which is located in a minuscule box of a room behind an unlocked door. "I'd forgotten all about these ratty old buggers," she says, pushing down on the handle of the incinerator chute door and allowing her son to do the honors, meaning he can perform the task of disposing of the shoes. And so little Timothy Quine takes hold of Hank, and as he casts him 7 floors down into the basement furnace, he says, "Goodbye, shoe." And then he takes hold of Frank and repeats the operation, saying, "Goodbye, shoe," as Frank follows his brother into the fire below. And before another day has dawned over the island of Manhattan, the two soulmates have been transformed into an indistinguishable mass of red, glowing cinders. Ferguson was in the 9th grade now, technically the first year of high school, but in his case the last year of junior high, and among the subjects he studied during the first semester was typing, an elective course that proved to be more valuable to him than anything else he took that year. Because he was so keen on mastering this new skill, he went to his father and asked for the money to buy a typewriter of his own, managing to persuade the prophet of prophets to cough up the cash with the argument that he was going to need one eventually, and prices would never be lower than they were now. And thus Ferguson secured himself a new toy to play with, a solid, elegantly designed Smith Corona portable, which instantly acquired the status of most treasured possession. How he came to love that writing machine, and how good it felt to press his fingers against the rounded concave keys and watch the letters fly up on their steel prongs and strike the paper, the letters moving right as the carriage moved left, and then the ding of the bell and the sound of the cogs engaging to drop him down to the next line, as black word followed black word to the bottom of the page. It was such a grown-up instrument, such a serious instrument, and Ferguson welcomed the responsibilities it demanded of him, for life was serious now, and with Artie Fetterman never more than half an inch away from him, he knew it was time to start growing up. When Ferguson completed the handwritten first draft of Soulmates in early November, he had made enough progress in his typing course to do the second draft on the Smith Corona. After he corrected that version and typed up the story again, the finished manuscript came to 52 double-spaced pages. It seemed incomprehensible to him that he had written so much, that somehow or other he had managed to crank out more than 15,000 words about a dumb pair of shoes. But after the idea came to him, one thing kept leading to another. His head kept filling up with new situations to write about, new aspects of the characters to explore and develop. And by the time he was finished, more than 2 months of his life had been given over to the project. He felt a certain satisfaction in having done it, of course. The mere fact of having composed such a long work was something any 14-year-old would have felt proud of. But when he read it over for the fifth time and made the last of his final revisions, he still didn't know if it was any good or not. Since neither one of his parents was capable of judging the story, let alone any story ever written in the history of mankind, and since Aunt Mildred and Uncle Don were in London for the fall semester, Mildred had been given a half-year sabbatical, which meant that Noah was living full-time with his mother and was therefore inaccessible until January. And since he was too frightened to share it with the one classmate whose opinion he would have trusted, he reluctantly gave it to his English teacher, Mrs. Baldwin, who had been standing in front of 9th-grade classrooms since the 1920s and was just a year or two from retirement. Ferguson knew he was taking a risk. Mrs. Baldwin excelled at giving vocabulary quizzes and spelling tests. She was masterful at explaining how to diagram a sentence and terrifically good at clarifying the tough points of grammar and diction. But her taste in literature belonged to the fuddy-duddy school of superannuated treasures, as evinced by her enthusiasm for Bryant, Whittier, and Longfellow, those turgid, insipid has-beens who dominated the curriculum when she led the class through, quote, the wonders of 19th-century American verse. And while Ferguson's dark-browed E.A. Poe was there with his obligatory black bird, there was no Walt Whitman, too profane, and no Emily Dickinson, too obscure. To her credit, however, Mrs. Baldwin had also assigned them A Tale of Two Cities, which was his first exposure to Dickens on the page. He had once watched the movie version of A Christmas Carol on TV. And though Ferguson had gladly joined his friends in the age-old tradition of referring to the novel as A Tale of Two Titties, he had fallen hard for the book, had found the sentences ferociously energetic and surprising, an inexhaustible inventiveness that mixed horror and humor in ways he had never encountered in any other book. And he was grateful to Mrs. Baldwin for having introduced him to what he now considered to be the best novel he had ever read. That was why he decided to give her his story, because of Dickens. Too bad he couldn't write as well as old Charles. But he was just a beginner, an amateur author with only one work to his name so far, and he hoped she would take that into account. It wasn't as bad as he thought it might be, but in other ways it was much worse. Mrs. Baldwin corrected his typos, spelling errors, and grammatical blunders, which not only was a help to him, but proved that she had read the story with some care. And when they sat down for their after-school conference 6 days after he had given her the manuscript, she praised him for his perseverance and the richness of his imagination. And to be perfectly frank, she added, she was stunned that an apparently normal, well-adjusted boy should have such dark, disturbing thoughts about the world. As for the story itself, well, it was ludicrous, of course, a blatant example of the pathetic fallacy gone wrong. But even granted that a pair of shoes could think and feel and carry on conversations, what had Ferguson been trying to accomplish by inventing this comic book world of his? There were unquestionably some touching and amusing moments, some flashes of genuine literary talent, but much of the story had offended her, and she wondered why Ferguson had chosen her to be his first reader, since he must have known she would be put off by his use of four-letter words, pigeon shit on page 17, holy shit on page 30, which she pointed out to him by tapping her finger on the lines in which those words appeared, not to mention his mockery of the police throughout, beginning with the derisory terms flatfoot and cop shoes, then deepening the insult with his portrayal of Captain Benton as a drunken, abusive sadist. Didn't Ferguson know that her father had been Maplewood chief of police when she was a girl? Hadn't she told the class enough stories about him to make that clear? But worst of all, she said, worse than anything else, was the smutty tone of the story. Not just that Quine hops in and out of bed with various unsavory women before he proposes to Alice, but that Alice herself is willing to sleep with him before their marriage, an institution, by the way, that Ferguson seems to hold in absolute contempt. And then, even worse than worst of all, the fact that the sexual innuendos don't stop with the human characters, but go all the way down to the shoes themselves. What a preposterous notion that was, the erotic lives of shoes, for pity's sake. And how could Ferguson look at himself in the mirror after writing about the pleasure a shoe feels when a foot steps into it, or the ecstasy that comes from being shined and polished? And how on earth did he ever think up that shoe orgy with Flora and Nora? That truly was the limit. And didn't Ferguson feel the least bit ashamed of himself for dwelling on such filth? He didn't know how to answer her, until Mrs. Baldwin started hammering him with her criticisms. He had assumed they would be talking about the mechanics of fiction writing, technical matters such as structure, pace, and dialogue, the importance of using one word instead of three or four words, how to avoid needless digressions and drive the story forward, the small but essential things he was still trying to figure out for himself. But it had never occurred to him that Mrs. Baldwin would attack him on what seemed to be moral grounds, calling into question the very substance of what he had written and condemning it as indecent. Whether she approved of the story or not, it was his work, and he was free to write whatever he wanted, to use the word shit if he felt it was necessary, for example, since people in the real world said that word 100 times a day, and even if he was still a virgin, he had learned enough about sex to know that you didn't have to be married in order to do it, that human lust paid little or no heed to the laws of matrimony. And as for the sexual life of shoes, how could she not see how funny it was, funny in such an absurd, innocent way that anyone reading those passages would have to be half dead not to crack a smile? And fuck her, Ferguson said to himself. She had no right to be reproaching him like this. And yet, in spite of his resistance, her words were doing the job she had intended them to do. They were scalding his insides and peeling off his skin. And so dazed was he by the assault that he didn't have the strength to defend himself. And when he was finally able to speak, he could get no more than 2 words out of his mouth, 2 mumbled words that surely ranked as the most pathetic words he had ever spoken. "I'm sorry." "I'm sorry, too," Mrs. Baldwin said. "I know you think I'm being hard on you, but it's for your own good, Archie. I'm not saying your story is obscene, not when you compare it to some of the books they've been publishing these past few years, but it's vulgar and distasteful, and I just want to know what you were thinking when you wrote it. Did you have anything in mind, or were you simply trying to shock people with a bunch of off-color jokes? Ferguson didn't want to be there anymore. He wanted to stand up and leave the room and never have to look at Mrs. Baldwin's wrinkled face and watery blue eyes again. He wanted to quit school and run away from home and ride the rails like a depression hobo, begging for meals at kitchen doors and writing dirty books in his spare time. A man beholden to no one, laughing as he spat in the face of the world. "I'm waiting, Archie," Mrs. Baldwin said. "Don't you have anything to say for yourself?" "You want to know what was in my mind, is that it?" "Yes, what you were thinking." "I was thinking about slavery," Ferguson said, "about how some people were actually owned by other people and had to do what they were told from the minute they were born until the minute they died. Hank and Frank are slaves, Mrs. Baldwin. They come from Africa, the shoe factory. Then they're put in chains and shipped to America on a boat, the shoebox, the truck ride to Madison Avenue. And then they're sold off to their master at a slave auction. But the shoes in your story like being shoes. You're not going to tell me that slaves liked being slaves, are you?" "No, of course not. But slavery lasted for hundreds of years. And how many times did the slaves rise up and revolt? How many times did slaves kill their masters?" "Almost never. Slaves did the best they could under bad conditions. They even told jokes and sang songs when they were able to. That's the story of Hank and Frank. They have to serve the will of their master, but that doesn't mean they don't try to make the most of what they have." "None of this comes through in the writing, Archie." "I didn't want to make it too obvious. Maybe that's a problem, or maybe you just missed it. I don't know. In any case, that's what I had in mind." "I'm glad you told me this. It doesn't change my opinion of the story, but at least I know you were trying to do something serious. I dislike it with all my heart, you understand. Dislike it all the more because some of it is so good. And because I'm such an old woman now, I suppose I'll always dislike what you do. But keep writing, Archie, and don't listen to me. You don't need advice. You just need to keep at it. As your dear friend Edgar Allan Poe once wrote to an aspiring author, be bold, read much, write much, publish little, keep aloof from the little wits, and fear nothing." He didn't tell her about the final pages of the story, or what he had been thinking when Alice puts Hank and Frank in the closet. If Mrs. Baldwin had missed the secret references to slavery, how could she have understood that the closet is a concentration camp, and that Hank and Frank are no longer black Americans at that point, but European Jews in the Second World War, wasting away in captivity until they are finally burned to death in the incinerator crematorium? It wouldn't have done any good to tell her that. Nor was there any reason to talk about friendship, which was the true subject of the story as far as he was concerned, because that would have meant having to talk about Artie Fetterman, and he had no desire to share his grief with Mrs. Baldwin. She could have been right about not making those things visible enough for a reader to detect them. But then again, she could have been blind. So rather than put the story away and stop thinking about it, he corrected the errors Mrs. Baldwin had circled on the manuscript and typed up yet another version, this time using carbon paper in order to make a second copy, which he airmailed to Aunt Mildred and Uncle Don the following afternoon. 12 days after that, he received a letter from London, which in fact was two letters in a single envelope, a separate response from each of them, both favorable and enthusiastic, neither one of them blind to the things his teacher had failed to notice. "What a puzzle," he said to himself, as a great surge of happiness swept through him. For even if his aunt and uncle had pronounced Soulmates to be a good story, their verdict did nothing to change the fact that Mrs. Baldwin still thought it was a bad story. The same manuscript perceived differently by different pairs of eyes, different hearts, different brains. It was no longer a question of one person being punched while another person was being kissed. It was the same person being punched and kissed at the same time. For that was how the game worked, Ferguson realized. If he meant to go on showing his story to other people in the future, he He would have to prepare himself to be punched as often as he was kissed, or punched 10 times for every kiss, or 100 times with no kiss at all. Rather than mail the story directly back to Ferguson, Uncle Don had sent it to Noah with instructions to return the manuscript to his cousin when he had finished reading it. Early one Saturday morning, about a week after the letters had arrived from London, the telephone rang in the kitchen as Ferguson was polishing off his breakfast of scrambled eggs and toast. And there was Noah on the other end of the line, spitting out words like Tommy gun bullets, saying he had to talk fast because his mother had stepped out to do some shopping and would probably kill him if she walked in and caught him on a long-distance call, especially a call to Ferguson, who was not to be contacted under any circumstances from the sanctuary of her apartment, not only because he wasn't Noah's real cousin, but because he was tied by blood to the bitch devil. Yes, Noah said, she was out of her mind, everyone knew that, but he was the one who had to live with her. And yet once he finished that breathless prologue of his, Noah immediately began to slow the pace of his delivery, and before long he was talking at normal speed, which was fast but not outrageously fast, and sounding like someone with all the time in the world to settle in for a nice, lengthy chat. "Well," Piss said, he began, "you've really done it this time, haven't you?" "Done what?" Ferguson replied, feigning ignorance, since he was more or less certain that Noah was referring to the story. "An odd little thing called Soulmates." "You've read it?" "Every word, 3 times. And?" "Fantastic, Archie, just fucking flat-out fantastic. To tell the truth, I didn't know you had it in you." "To tell the truth, I didn't either. I'm thinking we should turn it into a movie." "Very funny, and how do we do that without a camera?" "An insignificant detail. We'll remedy that problem in due course. Anyway, we don't have time to work on it now, because of school, for one thing, and the distance between New York and New Jersey, and assorted maternal impediments I won't go into today. But there's always the summer. I mean, we're finished with camp now, aren't we? We're too old for it. And after what happened to Artie, well, I don't think I could ever go back there." "I agree. No more camp. So we'll spend the summer making the movie. Now that you've turned yourself into a writer, I suppose you'll be giving up all that sports nonsense." "Only baseball, but I'm still doing basketball. I'm on a team, you know, a 9th grade team sponsored by the West Orange Y. We play other Y teams around Essex County twice a week, once on Wednesday night and once on Saturday morning." "I don't get it. If you want to go on being a jock, why quit baseball? It's your best sport." "Because of Artie." "What does Artie have to do with it?" "He was the best player we've ever seen, wasn't he? And he was also my friend. Not so much your friend, but my friend, my good friend. Now Artie's dead. I want to go on thinking about him. It's important to me to have him in my thoughts as much as possible. And the best way to do that, I realized, was to give up something in his honor, something I care about, something important to me. So I chose baseball. Baseball because that was Artie's best sport, too. And from now on, whenever I see other people playing baseball, whenever I think about why I'm not playing baseball myself, I'll think about Artie." "You're a strange person, do you know that?" "I guess, but even if I am, what can I do about it?" "Nothing." "That's right, nothing. So play basketball. Join a summer league if you want to, but as long as you're down to just one sport, you'll have lots of time to work on the movie." "Agreed, assuming we manage to get hold of a camera." "We'll get it, don't worry. The important thing is that you've written your first masterpiece. The door has opened, Archie, and there'll be many more to come, a whole lifetime of masterpieces. Let's not get carried away. I've written one thing, that's all, and who knows if I'll ever come up with another idea. Besides, I still have my plan." "Not that. I thought you dropped it ages ago." "Not really." "Listen to me," Piss said. "You're never going to be a doctor, and I'm never going to be a strong man in the circus. You don't have a math and science brain, and I don't have a single muscle in my body. Ergo, no Dr. Ferguson, and no Noah the Magnificent." "How can you be so sure?" "Because the idea came to you from a book, that's why. A stupid novel you read when you were 12 years old, which I had the misfortune to read because you insisted it was so good, which it isn't. And if you looked at it again, I'm sure you'd finally see that it isn't what you thought it was, that it isn't any damned good at all. Idealistic young doctor blows up contaminated sewer system in order to rid town of disease. Idealistic young doctor loses his ideals for money and a posh address. Formerly idealistic, not-so-young doctor regains his ideals and thus saves his soul. Hogwash, Archie, just the kind of crap to move an idealistic young boy like yourself. But you're not a young boy anymore. You're a strapping fellow with a man's dick yowling between your legs and a head that can produce literary masterpieces and God knows what else, and you're telling me you're still in thrall to that abomination of a book whose title escapes me now because I've done everything in my power to forget it. The Citadel. That's it. And now that you've reminded me, never say it again in my presence. No, Archie, a person doesn't become a doctor because he's read a book. He becomes a doctor because he needs to become a doctor. And you don't need to become a doctor, you need to become a writer. I thought this was going to be a short call. You haven't forgotten about your mother, have you? Damn it. Of course I have. Gotta go, Arch. Your father's coming back in a couple of weeks. We'll get together then, okay? You bet. We'll talk shoe to each other with thick Brogan brogues and figure out how to steal a camera. On December 19th, 3 days after Ferguson's conversation with Noah, the New York Times reported that American GIs had entered the war zone in South Vietnam and were now taking part in tactical operations with instructions to, quote, shoot if fired upon. Along with a shipment of 40 helicopters, 400 American combat troops had arrived in South Vietnam 1 week earlier. Additional aircraft, ground vehicles, and amphibious ships were on the way. In all, there were now 2,000 Americans in uniform in South Vietnam, quote, instead of the officially reported 685 members of the military advisory group. 4 days after that, on December 23rd, Ferguson's father left on a 2-week trip to Southern California to visit his brothers and their families. It was the first pause he had taken from work in years, the last one dating all the way back to December 1954, when he and Ferguson's mother had gone to Miami Beach for a 10-day winter vacation. This time, Ferguson's mother didn't go with him, nor did she accompany Ferguson's father to the airport to say goodbye to him on the day he left. Ferguson had heard his mother badmouth her brothers-in-law often enough to understand that she had no interest in seeing them. But still, there must have been more to it than that, for once his father was gone, she looked more agitated than usual, preoccupied, morose, unable, for the first time in memory, to follow what he was saying when he talked to her. And so deep was her distraction that Ferguson wondered if she wasn't brooding about the state of her marriage, which seemed to have taken some definitive turn with his father's solo departure to Los Angeles. Perhaps the bathtub wasn't really cold anymore. Perhaps it was frigid now, on the point of freezing over into a block of ice. The carbon copy of his story had been sent back by Noah as promised, and since it showed up in Maplewood before his father left for California, Ferguson had given it to him on the off chance that he might read it on the trip. His mother had read it weeks earlier, of course, on the Saturday after Thanksgiving, curled up on the couch in the living room with her shoes off and smoking half a pack of Chesterfields as she worked her way through the 52 typed pages, telling him afterward that she thought it was just wonderful, one of the best things I've ever read, which was to be expected, he supposed, since she would have delivered the same verdict if he had copied out last month's shopping list and passed it off as an experimental poem. But far better to have your mother on your side than not, especially with a father who seemed to be on no side at all. Now that soulmates had passed through the hands of Aunt Mildred, Uncle Don, and Noah, he figured it was time to screw up his courage, a phrase he loved for its double, contradictory meanings, and show it to Amy Schneiderman, the one person in Maplewood whose opinion he could trust, and therefore the person he had been most terrified to approach, since Amy was too honest to pull any punches, and a punch from her would have flattened him. In some ways, if not in many ways, Ferguson thought of Amy Schneiderman as a female version of Noah Marks, a more attractive version, to be sure, in that she was a girl and not a bug-eyed, muscleless boy, but she was smart in the way Noah was smart, the same kind of lit-up person he was, all ablaze and crackling with spirit. And over the years, Ferguson had come to realize how much he depended on them both, as if the two of them were a pair of butterfly wings he wore on his back to keep himself aloft. He who could be so heavy at times, so earthbound, and yet, in the case of the more attractive Amy, the physical attraction was not so great as to plant any amorous thoughts in Ferguson's head. And therefore she was still just a friend, albeit an essential friend, his most important comrade in the ever-expanding war against suburban dullness and mediocrity. And how fortunate it was that she, of all the people in the world, should be the one to occupy his old room, a narrative caprice in the story of their lives, perhaps, but it had formed a bond between them, a peculiar kind of closeness that they both took for granted now. For not only did Amy breathe the same air he had breathed in that house, she spent her nights in the same bed he had slept in when he lived there, a bed his mother had deemed too small for his room in the new house, and had consequently given to Amy's less than wealthy parents before they moved in. That was more than 5 years ago now, late summer 1956, and although Amy was supposed to have started the fifth grade in September, 2 days before the school year began, she fell off a horse on a riding trail in the South Mountain Reservation and broke her hip, and by the time the injury healed, it was already the middle of October, and so her parents decided to have her repeat the fourth grade instead of plunging her into a new school 6 weeks behind the other children in her class. That was how she and Ferguson wound up in the same grade together, the two of them born just 3 months apart, but destined to have slightly different trajectories in school. But then the broken hip intervened, and their trajectories became identical, beginning with that first year when they were fellow members of Miss Mancini's fourth grade class, and continuing on through their last 2 years at Jefferson Elementary School, and then all 3 years at Maplewood Junior High, always in the same classes together, always competing against each other, and because there had never been any romantic entanglements to divide them, with the inevitable misunderstandings and hurt feelings that come with romance, always friends. The morning after Ferguson's father left for California, Sunday, December 24th, the day before the holiday neither one of their families celebrated, Ferguson called Amy at 10:30 and asked if he could come over to her house. He had something to give her, he said, and if she wasn't too busy, he would like to give it to her right away. No, she said, she wasn't busy, just lounging around in her pajamas, reading the paper, trying not to think about the essay they were supposed to be writing over winter vacation. It was a 15-minute walk from his house to her house, a trip he had made on foot many times in the past. But the weather was ugly that morning, a fine drizzle falling with the temperature at 31 or 32 degrees, snow weather without any snow, but foggy, windy, and wet. So Ferguson said he would ask his mother to drive him there. In that case, Amy said, why didn't they both come for brunch? Jim had bagged out on them about 10 minutes earlier and was still in New York with his friends, but the food had been bought. There was enough to feed 10 starving people, and it would be a pity to waste it. Just a minute, she said, as she put down the phone and yelled out to her parents, asking if Archie and Mrs. Ferguson could come over and share our grub with us. Amy had a weakness for quaint idioms. And 20 seconds later, she picked up the phone again and said, it's fine. Come between 12:30 and 1. Thus, the manuscript of Soulmates was finally put in Amy's hands, and as Ferguson sat in his old room with the girl who spent her nights sleeping in his old bed, the two of them talked while the adults prepared the meal in the kitchen directly below them. First of all, about their current love dramas, Ferguson pining for a girl named Linda Flagg who had turned him down when he had asked her out to the movies on Friday, and Amy pinning her hopes on a boy named Roger Saslow, who had yet to call her but had hinted he would, assuming she had read the hint correctly. Then about her big brother Jim, an MIT freshman, who had been one of the stalwarts of the Columbia High School basketball team in his junior and senior years, and how upset he was, Amy said, about Jack Molinas and the college point-shaving scandal, dozens of games fixed over the past few seasons by bribing players with a few $100, while Molinas and his gambler pals cashed in big with tens of thousands a week. Everything in this country was fixed, Amy said, TV quiz shows, college basketball games, the stock market, political elections. But Jim was too pure to understand that. Maybe so, Ferguson said, but Jim was pure only because he saw the best in people, which was a good quality, he felt, one of the things he most admired about Amy's brother. And no sooner did Ferguson say the word admire than the conversation shifted to another subject, the essays they had to write for the school-wide competition in January. The topic was The Person I Most Admire, and everyone had to participate, every 7th, 8th, and 9th grader, with prizes going to the best 3 essays in each of the 3 grades. Ferguson asked Amy if she had chosen anyone yet. Of course I have. It's getting late, you know. We have to hand them in on January 3rd. Don't make me guess. I'm bound to get it wrong. Emma Goldman. The name rings a bell, but I don't know much about her. Just about nothing, in fact. I didn't either, but then my Uncle Gil gave me her autobiography as a present, and now I am in love with her. She's one of the greatest women who ever lived. A brief pause. And what about you, Mr. Ferguson? Any ideas yet? Jackie Robinson. Ah, Amy said, the baseball player. But not just any baseball player, right? The man who changed America. Not a bad choice, Archie. Go for it. Do I need your permission? Of course you do, silly. They both laughed, and then Amy jumped to her feet and said, Come on, let's go downstairs. I'm famished. On Tuesday, Ferguson went outside to retrieve the mail and found a hand-delivered letter sitting in the box. No stamp, no address, just his name written across the front. The message was succinct. Dear Archie, I hate you. Love, Amy. P.S. I'll return the MS tomorrow. I need one more ride with Hank and Frank before I let go. His father returned to Maplewood on January 5th. Ferguson was expecting him to say something about the story, if only to apologize for not having read it, but he said nothing. And when he continued to say nothing over the days that followed, Ferguson assumed he had lost it. Since Amy had returned the original typescript by then, the loss of the copy was of little importance. What counted was how little his father seemed to care about that matter of little importance. And because Ferguson resolved never to speak to him about it unless his father spoke to him about it first, it grew into a matter of great importance, of greater and greater importance, as time went on.